I write over the book of Judges, righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. That's Proverbs 14:34. You have in the book of Judges a philosophy of history, and a philosophy of history which has been followed down through the centuries. Isaiah comes to it also, and we're going to see it in this book as we get into it. Now, this book, apparently, the book of Judges, it records a period between Joshua and also the first king that came on the scene, which was Saul. And it was a period in which judges ruled. And you have here this particular period that's given to us. And the reason I say that this was written in that period is because I think about four times here in the book of Judges it says, in those days there was no king in Israel. Evidently it comes from the time when there was a king, and it looks back to the time when there was no king in the land. I think that is obvious there. And I believe that the verse that we'll have to refer to more than any others, the last verse in the book of Judges, in those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Every man did his own thing in that day. And it wasn't good, friends. The book of Judges is a book that will give to us a philosophy of history. I think that is one of the great purposes of the book. And we'll see that as we get into it. We have, for instance, I think a twofold purpose that the book serves. First of all, as to the historical purpose, it records the history of the nation Israel from the death of Joshua to Samuel, the last of the judges, and he, of course, was the first of the prophets. And it bridges the gap between Joshua and the rise of the monarchy under Saul. There was no leader to take Joshua's place, actually, in the way that Joshua had taken Moses' place. And this was the trial period of the theocracy after they entered the land. Now, the second, I think, purpose is a moral purpose. It is the time of the deep declension of the people as they turned from the unseen leader and descended to the low level of, well, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And that's the last verse that you find in this book. And we find how different it is from the first verse that opens this book. And I'll read the first verse. Now after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, who shall go up for us against the Canaanites first to fight against them? They turned to the Lord at the death of Joshua, but that didn't last long. And you find them, by the time you come to the end of the book, they have gone to the very low plane of every man doing that which is right in his own eyes. Every man was doing his own thing. And friends, when that comes about, well, look around you today and you'll see what I mean. Why are we in such a low level as far as morality is concerned today? Well, because every man's doing that which is right in his own eyes. And there's no lofty purpose or lofty goal in view. Now, this actually should have been a period of glowing progress and success. But it was a dark day, actually, of repeated failure. You see, the children of Israel entered the land of promise with high hopes and exuberant expectation. And you'd expect these people who were delivered out of Egypt, led through the wilderness, and brought into the land with such demonstration of God's power and direction to attain a high level of living and victory in the land. But such was not the case. They failed ignobly and suffered miserable defeat after defeat. And we'll see here a philosophy of history. And you will find that, and I think I should turn to that now. In the second chapter, at verse 11, here is their story. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Balaam. Now, you have here an old wheel of prophecy. I call it the hoop of history. And it begins with this nation serving God. Then we have these steps downward. They did evil in the sight of God, and they served Balaam. And then we're told, verse 12, they forsook the Lord God of their fathers, and they followed, we are told here, other gods, gods of the people that are round about them, bowed themselves unto them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. Now they forsook the Lord, and what happened? And served Baal and Ashtaroth. Now the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. And now the next step, he delivered them into the hands of spoilers that spoil them. And then the next step, he sold them into the hands of their enemies round about, and they could no longer stand before their enemies. And then they spent a time of servitude. And then what happened? Well, they cried out to God in their distress and in their sad plight. And when they cried out to God, they then turned to God, and they repented. And then God heard their prayer, judges were raised up, he delivered them, and then you have the nation again at the top of the hoop, and they're serving God. And then what happens? Same old story. They did evil, they forsook God, they followed their own pleasure, they were sold into slavery, there was a period of servitude, they cried to God, they turned to God, they repented, judges raised up, delivered. The nation serving God again. They're at the top. Uh-oh, here they go again, did evil. And my friend, old hoop just turns over and over and over. And you can follow right through the Bible, that hoop. And it's true today. The old bromide, history repeats itself, friends, is true. It's absolutely true. And this is the cycle of history that we're looking at. That's the reason we call this a philosophy of history. Now, when you get over to the book of Isaiah, we're going to find again that book opens with God giving this philosophy of history. And the way Isaiah puts it is quite interesting. He starts off again that there are three steps that every nation makes that goes down the drain. And what are those three steps? There is, first of all, spiritual apostasy. Then there is moral awfulness, and then third, there is political anarchy. And that's the last stage of any nation. You find that in the first chapter of Isaiah, and we'll see it when we get to that, of course, and that'll be quite a while yet. But this is something that you will find that has been true down through the history of mankind, and I'd like to give you a quotation from General Douglas MacArthur, along this same line. Will you listen to him? If you want to know how up-to-date the book of Judges is, in this day of gathering storms, as the moral deterioration of political power spreads its growing infection, it is essential that every spiritual force be mobilized to defend and preserve the religious base upon which this nation was founded. For it has been that base which has been the motivating impulse to our moral and national growth. History fails to record a single precedent in which nations subject to moral decay have not passed into political and economic decline. There has been either a spiritual reawakening to overcome the moral lapse or a progressive deterioration leading to ultimate national disaster. Same thing, way back in the book of Judges, you have this philosophy of history that is given. Now, what did God do? God raised up judges to deliver his people when they apostatized and cried to him in their misery. And these judges ruled between Joshua and Samuel, by the way. And the book takes its name from these men whom God raised up. They were judges. They exercised their ministry, some of them in a local and restricted area, and that is true of most of them. But all the judges were themselves limited in their capabilities. In fact, each one seemed to have some defect and handicap which was not a hindrance, but became a positive asset under the sovereign direction of God. None of them were national leaders who appealed to the total nation as Moses and Joshua had done. The record is not continuous, but rather a spotty account of a local judge in a limited section of the nation. Now, with that in mind, let's come to chapter 1 here. And you will find in this chapter here that there are 9 of the 12 tribes mentioned, and they're all mentioned in their failure. And the 3 that are not mentioned are Reuben, Issachar, and Gad, and I assume that they likewise fail. Each tribe faced a particular enemy, and at no time was the entire nation engaged in a warfare against any particular enemy. You see, the weakness of the tribes is revealed from the very word go. Now, notice this. We are told that at first here, they asked the Lord what they were to do and who will go for them against the Canaanites. Now, the Canaanites were well entrenched in that land. They hadn't been driven out, and they were a thorn in the side of Israel during the reign of Saul and during the reign of David. How will you notice as we read on here in verse 2? And the Lord said, Judah shall go up. Behold, I have delivered the land into his hand. In view of the fact that the Canaanite nation, for the most part, was in the land allotted to Judah and to the one that became his sidekick, if you please, Simeon. And we're told in verse 3 something that reveals the innate weakness of this nation and of the tribes. Listen at verse 3. And Judah said unto Simeon his brother, come up with me into my lot, that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I likewise will go with thee into thy lot. So Simeon went with him. Now you say, well, how is that a sign of weakness? It looks like a fine sign of cooperation. Well, that part I'll agree with. But it was real weakness, very frankly, for Judah to ask another tribe to help them drive out the Canaanites in their own particular land. They should have been able to do it themselves and should have gone out to do it themselves. And as a result, why, they never were totally driven out. We find in verse 4, and Judah went up, and the Lord delivered the Canaanites, the Perizzites, into their hand, and they slew of them in Bezek 10,000 men. Now you would think that after this first step, that the people in Judah would be now confident and that God would deliver it into their hands. Now we're told in verse 9, though, and afterward the children of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites that dwelt in the mountain and in the south and in the valley, and Judah went against the Canaanites that dwelt in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron before was Kirjath Arba, and they slew Sheshiah and Ahiman and Talmai. And from thence he went against the inhabitants of Debir, and the name of Debir before was Kirjath Sepher. That means it was a city of books, by the way. It was the library. And Caleb said, he that smiteth Kirjath Sepher and taketh it to him will I give Aksah, my daughter, to wife. And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it, and he gave him Aksah, his daughter, to wife. Now, somebody's going to say, Well, you've made the statement there's a weakness in each one of the judges. It looks like Othniel does pretty well. Now, very frankly, Othniel is the best of the judges, in my judgment. But there is this sign of weakness. Why was he chosen here as the judge at this particular time? Why was he the one? Well, he was the son-in-law of Caleb. And you have this awful thing here of nepotism. You have this business of it's in the family. And if he hadn't been the son-in-law of Caleb, Caleb was well known. He was one of the two men that came out of Egypt that entered the land. He and Joshua, he was probably known just about as well as Joshua was known. And very candidly, Othniel would never have got the position as a judge if he hadn't been the son-in-law of Caleb. If he'd been the son-in-law of Joe Doakes, he wouldn't have been elected a judge, never been chosen for that. That's quite interesting, you see. How many men today occupy a position not because of the ability that they have, are because of the fact that they have the capability, but simply because of a position that might be due to a relationship or to a circumstance. You know, Napoleon actually was called a man of destiny, and he very frankly said that you not only have to have the man, but you have to have the point in history. In other words, if Napoleon had lived 50 years ago, even today, nobody had ever heard of him. It takes the man and the circumstance. And Othniel is the judge. Why is he a judge? Well, because his father-in-law happens to be Caleb, and that's the way that he came into this position. Now you have, in this chapter 1, 9 of the 12 tribes that are mentioned, and they're all mentioned in connection with failure. Verse 21, now we've had Judah and Simeon. Here's a little Benjamin. And the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites that inhabited Jerusalem. But the Jebusites dwelt with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem under this day. That is the day that Judges was written. And we find that it was something that persisted in each one of the tribes, by the way. We find in verse 27, neither did Manasseh drive out the inhabitants of Beth-shean. Verse 29, neither did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites that dwelt in Gezer. Verse 30, neither did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of Kitron. Verse 31, neither did Asher drive out the inhabitants of Akko. And then verse 33, neither did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants of Beth-Shemesh. And verse 34, and the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains. They had not suffered them to come down into the valley. And they chased Dan up into the hill country up there. May I say to you, friends, they are in the promised land. God has given it to them. But not one tribe apparently was able to lay hold of the land that God had given unto them. And what a tragic thing that it was.